Hello. So here we are in UCD on the fifth floor of the library, and we're going to be speaking today with Professor Kathleen Lynch. And I just want to say thank you so much for having us here in your office this afternoon.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And I would say, like, I used to have an office on this floor, so I know Kathleen on a personal level as well. We've run into you many times in the canteen and elsewhere, and I have to say that you've been very friendly and very encouraging and very supportive. And just so thank you so much for agreeing to take part. So, you're the Professor of Equality Studies here at UCD. You are outstanding in your field. You are very, very passionate, considered very, very passionate as an academic within the work that you do. You've held many prestigious roles along the course of your career. You've been a Marie Curie Scholar, Visiting Fellow at the University of Cambridge, and you have also held many Irish Research Council scholarships for your work. But I think one of the most important aspects of what you do is that you consider yourself an academic and also an activist in your work. So you feel that the purpose of academic research is not just to kind of understand elements of society, but also to try to create change with what you have discovered. Is that kind of fair
enough? That's right, yeah. I think that it's very important as an academic, especially if you write about social justice, that you don't become a colonizer of other people's miseries.
And what do you mean by that?
I'll tell you, Kathleen O'Neill, who is a very famous activist here in Dublin, from Kilbarrack. Kathleen and I wrote a paper in 1994, which happens to be now 4 years ago, on class and colonisation. And what motivated us was that many people write about injustices, and they don't ever think, will this piece that I write or that I teach about ever bring about any change? Or will I just make my career by writing papers?
So, and can I ask, do you find that many people who are writing about injustice, and of course I assume if people are going into that field, they're going at it because they are, you know, it's a noble kind of area, I suppose, to be looking at.
I think you need to be careful, because you can be delusional about yourself. You need a lot of reflexivity and rethinking of your position, not just as an individual, but collectively. And I think this is a huge issue for the universities in general, particularly people who write about any kind of inequality or injustice, because there is a danger that the career structure of the academy is such that it rewards you for just publishing. It doesn't reward you for activism. So, and that's true nowadays under neoliberalism in particular, when we have increasingly commercialised universities, people are under so much pressure to publish.
So I think for a lot of people who maybe wouldn't understand or wouldn't be aware of what the work of an academic is, so they know that they're going on. So this particular series of conversations that I'm holding is with the key thinkers from the Politics and Society course. I'm hoping this is going to be a good resource for students of the Politics and Society course. So many of these students will be going on to university, and they know that they'll have basically lecturers who come in and act as teachers. But what they may not be aware of is that the other half of the job as an academic really is that you're supposed to publish. And there is a phrase, publish or perish, which means that you either are publishing and writing books or articles or contributing to conferences. And if you're not out there creating new work constantly and contributing new pieces of knowledge, that you kind of fade out of the relevant circles of that world. Is that fair?
I think that's true. But I also think that, you know, what we have to do as academics is we have to bridge two very different worlds, you know, and certainly I think all scholarship that this applies, not just to academics, to professionals as well, that you must enable the people about whom you speak, or maybe if you relate to as a nurse or a teacher or a doctor, to have the capacity to come back to you and to criticise what you do and what you say. Mm-hmm. And if you don't do that, you become sometimes a remote professional. And I would say that to anybody in the service industry, an occupational therapist, a physiotherapist, not just to academics, that they can become just careerists living out their lives regardless of what benefit they have. They get a salary, they get security if they're employed by the state. There are a lot of ancillary secondary benefits to these positions, but often we don't bring about any change or attempt to bring out any change on the conditions of injustice of people. Now, that's a difficult thing to do, but I still think it's how we teach matters. How we teach people to think of knowledge differently. Knowledge is not just a package that you actually buy or own. It's not a deposit, as Paulo Freire says, that you kind of accrue to yourself and then you gain interest on it by getting a degree or a diploma or your leaving cert. Knowledge is transformative action. And by that I mean that when you create it, you're always seeing how can this knowledge contribute to social change.
Otherwise it's kind of useless, essentially.
It yeah, just sits well, on it a shelf sits in the book. Shelf. Or, but how can I give it to people who then can come to own it and reclaim it in a way that will enable them to have the capacity to bring about change themselves? I don't bring about change for people. That's an illusion. No, that is an illusion that people... But people themselves need to have that knowledge in a way that's accessible, in a way that they can use it. And then I think the universities in particular and teachers and scholars of all kinds have a duty to make that knowledge accessible and to bring it to communities outside those who can just afford to pay for it to get a degree.
Yes, yeah. And I think that's really important for people who are maybe considering that they have a unique perspective. I mean, like, there's a lot to be said for having experience of social injustice yourself, whether it's a gender issue or a sexual orientation issue or a disability issue, whatever. Like, I think there is so much to be said for having that personal experience and being able to bring that into academia as well.
If I can use academic language for the Leaving Cert students, there is an epistemological, which is a view of knowledge, position, which is there are two kinds of knowing. There's knowing something from theory that you learn from books, and there's also knowing from experience. So you have what we call experiential knowledge, which you're speaking about, and you have propositional or theoretical knowledge. In my view, those two forms of knowledge have to have a dialogue all the time. Otherwise, we become irrelevant, because most of us in everyday life, people who are in academic life, we are professionals. I think this doesn't just apply to academics, by the way. To people who are working, providing healthcare for people, providing education. I think there is a danger they become remote and they start to see people just as their clients, that dreadful language, customers, which is abhorrent to me. And they forget that, in fact, they exercise power over people and they have a duty to inform and enable people so that people have knowledge themselves.
Yes, yes, yes. And can I just ask, in terms of representation then within academia, do you think that there is kind of a lack of balance then in terms of people who have this experiential knowledge versus people who have a theoretical knowledge?
Oh, I do. Yes, I do. And I think that I wrote a paper in 1999 about developing emancipatory research practices, which is that we actually become partners with people and we enable partnerships to happen in the university, not just at an individual level, but at the level of the organisation, so that we constant dialogue and constant questioning of our own position. And the community groups need to be resourced and enabled and develop a research capacity. And so the civil society organisations who are promoting social justice critique and inform what we do in the academy.
Because it's a real lack to the overall research then if you don't engage all of these resources that you have. Like, say, for example, if we wanted to tackle as academics a drug problem in a specific area, we'll say in rural Ireland. If we don't speak to the people who are experiencing those problems, the families of the people, the people who are working and engaging with the services of those areas, if we don't gather all of those resources and try and put them together to get the whole picture, then the research is lacking if it's just coming from one academic's perspective and saying, well, theoretically, I understand everything there is to know about why people take drugs.
I think that's why a lot of policies fail. A lot of social policies fail because we don't want to hear. Often what most marginalised people, like prisons to me, are the prime example. Prisons are completely dysfunctional. They're a complete and utter waste of money. And if you take prisons in Ireland, the vast majority of people in them are men. They're men who are poor.
Actually,
and they have alcoholic and drug-related issues, 60%.
When I was reading your bio on the UCD page, on your own UCD page, I noticed, is it one of maybe your PhD students is doing a piece on, at the moment on young men and kind of, I guess, that what you were just speaking about there, that profiling of how basically it's just a pathway for a certain type of person who ends up within that system, the prison system in Ireland. Is that right, one of your students?
Well, yes, it was somebody they finished, but at the moment. But I'm just saying they were looking at how economic inequality, and in that case as well, looking at how economic inequality, class-based inequality, interfaces with other injustices, maybe lack of respect for people's racial identity, their sexual identity, and also their care identity, because often people, if you have economic inequality, you experience other multiple injustices which compel you and enable you to enter into, become very vulnerable in society and end up in those situations. Mm-hmm. But all I'm saying is we don't listen, we don't hear, and sometimes we have top-down policies and everything, and that's why they just don't work. Because yes. We don't hear the experiential knowledge. And the thing about it is, it has to be a continual dialogue.
And it has to be respectful dialogue. You have to like really appreciate and genuinely give and, people and a place at the table.
And keep it open all the time. But yeah, I think this is a role the universities haven't taken on seriously, because they're so focused now on, you know, their funding position, etc. I think they don't realise, perhaps particularly in the social sciences, mm-hmm. I think where it's very problematic. Yeah. Where people start to come out and they create professional elites who then, you know, I've seen it in my lifetime. Mm-hmm. You know, social workers and psychologists who were hadn't this big professional status, and everybody gets a professional status. It's a claim to power.
Yes, it's prestige and privilege, and then it and kind of feeds itself. It's kind
and
of
then
circle.
They become more and more distant. I'm not saying there aren't great people in those professions. There are, but I'm only saying just like there are problems for academics, I think there are also problems for similar.
But there's also, I think, like it's kind of like okay, that is certainly. Definitely an issue there that you highlighted, but also, you know, we're talking about various institutions in Ireland, for example, so we're talking about prisons, universities, secondary schools. Like when we look at how these institutions and structures have not changed, really it's very, very difficult, I suppose, to change the structure of an institution like a prison, for example, that has, you know, you're talking about huge amounts of money, you're talking about trials and experiments of trying to pilot change. I mean, there's a role for the bigger cohort of people, I mean, but that can only happen if there is an avenue for society to input, right?
Yeah, and I think that's where we're not good on dialogue. You see, let's go back to the bigger picture which you've raised there. If you have a hierarchically stratified society, which ours is, it's not as bad as others, but it's worse.
When you talk about hierarchically
stratified,
I mean,
stratified, that we'd say there's class stratification, you know. We know that economic inequality is very substantial in this country, very class divided, especially between the very rich and middle income, then together, and very poor people. There is a polarisation. And when you have that there, you know, it's sad to say, but some people in this country have earned enough, or not earned, but got enough money, acquired it, and certainly on a global scale they have, that they can live, and their families can live, in perpetuity in wealth, and other people live in destitution. So it is a zero-sum game in terms of money. And if some of us live very privileged lives, we do so at the cost of people who don't. And I think one of the great myths is that most people seem to think that you earn this, the myth of meritocracy. Mm-hmm. It is a complete myth, because yes, there are some ways in which people achieve certain things, but the way in which we see the probability of people from certain classes, or now or new ethnic minority groups like travellers, you know, over many generations experiencing isolation or disrespect or poverty, it is not accidental, and it is not based on individual merit.
And it's the structures, of policy,
and
laws,
I mean, we,
and everything else
Ireland,
that we maintain.
We are fairly
that.
Anti-intellectual. That's one thing I do want to say. You know, it's very hard if you take our main media. I mean, really, the mainstream media don't critique capitalism. They just don't. There's a few individuals who do. But there's no sustained, systematic critique of the capitalist project and the harm that it does to people when it becomes, you know, a kind of gospel that is a hidden doxa that Bourdieu speaks about, the hidden, you know, the unspoken set of values of assumption of society, and that this is the only way to live. But of course, this is not the only way to live. There are many ways in which we could cooperate, produce wealth. We could distribute that wealth much more evenly and equally. There are models of cooperative production throughout the world. There's a global cooperative movement. We could produce goods and services very differently, but we don't have that conversation here. We don't have that conversation in Ireland, and I think that that is a major problem for people, because if we don't have a new vision, if we don't have a different view of how you can live life, it's very hard for young people to think other than
so we accept, you know.
Well, I always draw the analogy between this generation who are in school now and in college and wherever else, and my generation, which is a lot older, when we were, when I was young, the it was going out of fashion, but it was still there, that the ideal thing to do was to become religious, a nun or a priest, especially for men. Nuns weren't as highly ranked as the gender order of this society as priests were. And people, the religious orders went around and they kind of, you know, proselytizing, you could say, but they tried to get vocations and people signed up. Now what we have is in the universities, we have the big multinationals who come round, just like the religious orders went to schools. They come round the universities. They do what are called the milk rounds, namely they go around and they see, eat, greet and greet, and they offer wine and canapés and whatever. And the big companies, the big accountancy firms, the big banking, the big law firms, and they say, come to us, we will save you. And young people think it's wonderful. I got into such and such a company. And parents boast about how wonderful it is that my child got into a graduate program. So it's exactly the same. The analogy is the very same. Their conversion is to capitalism. That's all it is. It's proof, living proof of how we have bought capitalism. It's the very same process, the very same type of conversion, and the very same sense of adulation that people have and sense of joy for their children because they've got into some big capitalist enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is where Ireland is at.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very, very strong culturally. And I saw myself, a neighbour, a very nice person, came over to tell me that his daughter got into a very prestigious law firm. And I remember thinking, this is amazing. And it fascinating. It was like the time that people would go and say, my son is going to be
Minister. So it used to be prestigious to be very moral and to get into the church. And now the prestigious thing is to belong to a capitalist organisation.
It is. Yeah. There is no question about that. It is the mark of your achievement, and people regard it as a great mark of achievement for their children and for themselves, mm-hmm. that they have arrived. Because I'm not blaming people, because it's not that people go out and intentionally do this. They see it as giving them economic security and prestige. But I'm just saying, we have reversed the moral order, and the moral order has been reclaimed. It's, you know, so many churches, especially minority religion churches now, have been turned into enterprises and places where people are running all kinds of businesses. And it's reflective, even our own, what was the College of Education in Blackrock, run by the Mercy Order, is now the School of Business.
That's right, yeah.
And people don't see the conversions, but that is actually what's happening. I'm not saying we haven't got to live and we live in a capitalist world order, but I think it's no harm to observe and to reflect on how we have changed. I'm not saying one society was better than another, but certainly it is definitively a different set of values.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Can we return to how you came into the world of academia? How did you enter? I mean, I know that you began life as a social worker, is that correct?
Well, I didn't really. I did, and I didn't, is the answer to that. I did sociology.
Here at UCD?
Yes, I did. And then I also did social policy. And I did,
so master's in social policy?
No, I didn't. I did my master's in sociology and my PhD in sociology. Yeah, I did everything in sociology. But what happened was I also did social work as an option, you know, a minor option. And then I thought I would like it. I absolutely hated it, I have to say, because I felt that all we were doing was mopping up the injustices of the state. And I just...
You weren't tackling any of the major policies that could create these larger changes.
I'm not blaming people. That may work, may need to be done, but I wasn't the person to do it. So I didn't really... I said I did a... I went into research more by accident than by design. I couldn't say that I was clear. Well, I did economics as well and philosophy because we had, in those days, you had to do those subjects as part of your undergraduate degree when you were doing social science. And so then I went into, I did a, you know, I got a job in research in the Education Research Centre. Again, not a big plan job, but somebody told me there was a job there and I went for the interview, that kind of way, you know. And then I did a master's in sociology, and after that, I was very disillusioned with academia, actually. I felt what I've just said at the very beginning. I felt an awful lot of it was about... it wasn't about being radical or bringing about radical change. And whereas I felt an academic should be... I often say we're artists of the intellect. We're granted for the freedom from necessity to think and to write. Mm-hmm. And because of that, we have to remain autonomous and distant from all forms of power. You can never ingratiate yourself with anybody, be it business, be it trade unions, be it civil society. You must always be distant, because an artist is always distant. Yes. You're always on the periphery. Whereas I felt that the academy, and more so now than even when I first entered it, was in fact drawn, became apologists for a power, institutions of power. I mean, it kind of took on and analysed the welfare state, but everything, you know, well, is welfare state a solution to anything? And if so, what kind of solution? I felt it was always very careful, especially in Ireland.
And why was that? Because was it a money issue or was it a religious issue?
You mean that the academy was like that? I think here in Ireland, certainly as you know, and certainly when I was a youngster, I mean, it's very conservative. The social sciences were extremely conservative. We didn't learn Marxism. I read Marx myself afterwards when I was a PhD student, and I spent part of my time with Eric Golan Wright and other Michael Apple in the United States and Wisconsin and Madison. And I learned critical thinking outside of Ireland. I didn't learn it in Ireland.
Do you think that that's something that hopefully this course on politics and society will kind of start to bring into the secondary school sector,
well,
this idea of critical thinking?
I hope the students are listening. No, I spent my entire life from the early 1980s trying to introduce sociology and politics and critical dispositions within them into a second level education. I felt it should have been there. I don't see how people can live in a society without understanding its social systems and its
politics. And having the ability to question.
Yes.
And then beyond that, having the ability to criticise it then.
Absolutely.
If you want to.
And I mean, that's the nature of democracy as well.
That's a good citizen, somebody who has the loyalty to the state to be able to engage with it and to dissent.
And to
say,
have the language, you see, because the problem is if you don't have the language to name the world, you can't actually understand it.
And the confidence to stand up and kind of speak out and say if you see something that you think
that's what I hope the course will give to people, because it's very important that we get young and not so young people, it's not just young people, who have the capacity to go and analyse the media, to go and analyse institutions of power, and to analyse them critically and analytically, and not to take the received wisdom of the day and say this is the truth, because truth is a very complex issue and a multifaceted and a multi-perspectival issue. There's no one.
It's very easy to kind of become socialised into it and to just accept, as you say, the position of the day and kind of go along and just get caught up with your own life. Our lives are so busy, you know. Social media, you know, that can really drive a sense of what your life is supposed to look like and what you should be interested in. And, you know, I think, you know, to get
analysing,
to think
I don't
themselves.
Know whether it'll happen in the course, but analysing the power and scale and influence of social media on yourself is a project to be delivered in this course, because I think that it is who controls social media, how is it controlled, who controls the platform. Remember, always the question you must ask is who is pulling the strings that inform your consciousness, because your mind is a site of political struggle. Your mind is where ideological institutions try to create and form your consciousness, and one of the ways in which they create that consciousness is through media. And
what is appropriate, what is acceptable,
what
is normal.
That's why education is the only, if you take the institutions of ideology, to go back to Althusser, religion, education and the media, the only one of those that remains under public control in a very real sense is education. And therefore education, to think critically and analytically, is absolutely vital, so that we see through the mistruths are, you know, the deceptions and the fact that people who are powerful will put out agendas on the media. People say things like, the news is on. There is no such thing as the news.
There is things that people have, somebody has
defined as your news for the day, or put on your news feed, or wherever. So always to take everything problematically and to take nothing as the social scientific word for granted.
Yeah, but even if we look at something like that young people are faced with on a daily basis in terms of social media, what is the idea of beauty? You know, now I know we're kind of getting away from social policy now, but this is something, I guess, that everybody, as a woman, we can all relate to, particularly because we can be targeted very much in terms of social
media. Oh,
yeah,
I think it is extremely
dangerous.
Who
defines what beauty is? And that's just one example. Who defines what fairness is? And that's actually one of the things when I was doing a little bit of research about your own work was I came across, and there's many resources online of you speaking at various events, and this was the task.
Oh,
it was a you were the keynote speaker at the TASC conference. And the lady who introduced you spoke about fairness and how you have tried to kind of, like, we talk about fairness and how that's so important to consider fairness and what's fair. But the idea of what is fair and what's not actually is very difficult to define, particularly in law. And that is what can kind of set the barometer of what happens within a country and within a society. And you tend to focus more so on the idea of justice and equality.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think the word fairness is very dangerous because what is fair to one and what is fair to another is completely different. And who will define the terms of fairness? As I said, I think in that lecture, there is no law that defines what fairness means, but we do have equality legislation. We do have international human rights laws. We do have legislation within Europe that defines parameters, in even if it is only limited to what equality of opportunity is. And we do have actual legislation that clarifies that. But fairness is arbitrary, it's defined by the people who are in power, and it is a term that came into use, interestingly, about 10 or 15 years ago. And what fascinated me and depressed me in equal measure was the extent to which it came from neoliberalism and was adopted by parties of the so-called left in Ireland without and treated completely unproblematically.
Mm-hmm.
They just erased the concept of equality and replaced it with fairness. Fairness means whatever you're having yourself, because you can have a very fair system of rules and regulations in an unjust society.
Yes, and that kind of returns to that language, the importance of language. Well, that's one thing that, like, I've only come into, like, I've been a secondary school teacher for the past 15 years or so, and had no interest in politics, had no interest in any of these things, and I really wanted to do sociology, and I've only recently come back into that, you know, the last maybe 5 years, doing my master's and now doing my PhD. And the one thing that keeps cropping up over and over and over again is the importance of language and how you define what words mean, the real essential. So you talk about one sentence, like, if you haven't got a very, very clear definition of what that means, and that's what you're talking about, hopefully, say, a course like politics and society will empower people with the language and the understanding of what words mean. But so just to talk about you know, the idea of equality and rights, you talked about human rights framework. You know, it assumes that people have the capacity to change their rights, but actually the truth is that many of the people who are in need of having their rights protected don't actually have the capacity to kind of speak up for themselves or to look out for their own rights, or maybe even have the knowledge of what their rights are.
Yeah, I think so. Well, if, you know, you create a society where people don't know what their resources are, they don't know what their rights are, you don't educate people systematically, of course they won't claim those rights. Because that's another problem, I suppose, is the individualised nature of human rights. And not at the time you literally have to claim them. And people who are vulnerable often are not in a, people with intellectual disabilities, for example, often are not in a position to claim their rights. So we have to have, and this is something I suppose I've written about in a different kind of way, I think we have to move a line and not say that individual rights don't matter. They do, and it's very important that we can protect them and claim them. But we must also have a wider ethic in society that is an ethic of what I have called affective equality, which is affective justice, and not care as dependency, but respect, have an ethic of care that says we will create a society of solidarity which protects people, and they won't always, their rights will be protected without always having to go to court to claim them. And I think that's a huge problem here. Most of our equality legislation, you can only vindicate your rights if you're a traveller and somebody decides that they won't give you a flat. I have plenty of experience with this.
So say, for example, there's a private landlord
who
has discriminated against you because you're a member of the travelling community.
Yeah, they may
and
won't.
Then in order for you to get over that, you have to spend a lengthy amount of time in court. Which means you not just that you have to give up your time and your money and whatever, but the, I mean, going to court, I had to go to court one time because somebody stole my purse and I caught this person and the police, whatever. And even for me going in as the person, you know, who was the victim as such, it was a scary experience. I mean, it's an intimidating process.
Well, most people don't do it because they feel that it's not worth their while. I'm not saying the Equality Authority does work. Yeah. Well, it's now the Equality and Human Rights Commission. They do assist people. But what I'm trying to say is, if we create a society where the only kind of rights and protections you have are ones that you're able to claim, then the people who are most vulnerable, who often need to claim and be protected, will never do so, because they don't have the resources, the capacity, the time or the money or the energy to do so. Mm-hmm. And that is why we need a bigger and a stronger kind of a different kind of politics in Ireland.
So what are you proposing would be about the solidarity?
I'd say politics of solidarity, but not just a solidarity that's built on the idea of kind of almost a self-interest, because all our politics at the moment is built on different groups, if you like, promoting and protecting their self-interest.
Mm-hmm.
And that will always be there, I don't doubt that. But politics is not only about that. Politics is also about creating a new politics in society and a vision of society which is socially just. And coming with that vision downwards and saying, we will create a society where your rights will be protected. We will have, for example, you could have a class action, which you can't have in this country at the moment under our equality legislation, where we'd say 10 travellers or 10 people with disabilities experience discrimination, and as a group they can go and take a case.
Mm-hmm.
Now that, I think, is absolutely vital.
Powerful.
Because you feel so alone if you're going on your own. Those kind of changes, which are not radical changes, and you made a point earlier on that things like changing the prison system would cost a lot of money. No, it would cost very little money relative to the cost of running it at the moment, which is something in the region of 70,000 per head per prisoner, which is a complete and utter waste of money. A lot of these things would not, you know, we need more rehabilitation, we need drug treatment programs, we need people who are really need support services and who are emotionally vulnerable, not just financially impoverished, you know. And all those are a different view of society and a different view of vulnerability, which is endemic to the human condition for all of us.
Yes. Very interesting. Sorry, I got so caught up in it. That was so powerful listening to you there. I've lost my next question.
All right. Okay,
I just feel so empowered right now. I'm going to do it. I'm going to change it. But so just like the four areas that they have focused on in on the handout, the resource that the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment have given here on their website, is economic inequality, power inequality, particularly focused on the media, culture and status inequality, and effective inequalities. And that they talk about non-interference there. So what do you mean by that? That's the one kind of area that I kind of feel it, maybe it's not like self-explanatory there.
Yeah, effective inequality.
Yeah, effective inequalities.
Well, the whole idea is, and when most of us think of social justice, we think of three areas. Most of the politics and sociology and social policy and all those fields, they look at economic injustice, class-based. They look at status ones around gender, age, sexuality, disability, race. They look then at recognition, what we call redistribution recognition, and the other is power, which is parity of representation and the exercise of power. Are there power injustices, right? But there is, we are all relational beings. Human beings are created through one another. We create through one another through the nurturing of each other. We do it in families and communities, we do it at work or we don't do it at work. Of course, this can be negative as well as positive, and we do it at the level of the state and the global order. So we are not just cerebral beings, we're not just economic beings, or nor are we political, or are we cultural. We're also emotional beings who live our lives and understand the meaning of life and give purpose to life through our relationships with others. And in those relationships is a major site of injustice. Not just who does care work in the family, which is a common thing that people would look at, but who gets care? Because to be deprived of nurturing care is a serious human deprivation. It's as big a deprivation as it is to be deprived of food.
And for the state, the relationship that we have as citizens, as individual citizens with our state, to have that massive lack of something in our politics, like care, to be recognised as a really important part of how we run our society.
It's a huge kind of fundamental. It's a missing variable. And I think if we have to explain it to the students, it's because women mostly did care work. Women were the default carers in our society. You know,
both paid and unpaid,
exactly,
right?
Exactly. Default, paid and unpaid. They do that work. And that work has been treated, and that's a limit of liberal political theory as well, not just of This is not just applied to Ireland, it's global. Liberal political theory has not taken the care relations of life, the affective domain, which is what these relationships where we care for one another in the intimate sphere here, our friends and family, in the secondary care sphere at work in our community, and at the level of the state, the three circles of care. And it hasn't addressed that at all because it's seen as to be a private matter. But all I'm saying is that when we ignore that, we ignore a huge dimension of human existence. We ignore it politically. We forget that people have to have time to care for their children. They have to have time. They can't be commuting an hour and a half to work in the morning and an hour and a half in the evening and not come home exhausted. I'm sorry, that's the reality. And yet, we create a society where we don't build houses near where people work, we make it inaccessible places for people to live, and then we wonder why people are stressed. You know, So there are two major, you know, there's a recent book, I don't know if this, Wilkinson and Pickett book called The Inner Level.
The Spirit Level, yeah. And then this is the next one,
but The Inner Level. I've just read it, and it's well worth reading for people in school because it's very accessible and extremely well written. And it's about how, in that case, economic inequality feeds into all these status differentiations and you feel lesser because you don't have money and you don't have good clothes and, you know, and but we need to talk about that. But also when you have huge economic inequalities, people suffer materially in a way that impacts on their ability to care for one another.
Mm. Can you explain that a little bit?
We know, for example, when there's, can I use a phrase my father used to use? When hunger comes in the door, love runs out the window.
I've heard that phrase, absolutely, yes.
And it's very simple. When you're under economic strain, when people don't have enough money to meet the basics of life, or even what is socially required in life, to go to another kid's birthday party, for example. Mm-hmm. That's a very common thing. Mm-hmm. Going to birthday parties in Dublin City is, in many cases, a very expensive affair. Mm-hmm. So people feel, I can't participate, I can't belong, I don't actually, you know, I can't be part of that society. So what I'm saying is, we know that domestic violence rises, for example.
We know that there's a statistic of, or certainly a reported findings of emasculation when a man, which, like, as this gender role that has been perpetuated within our society, as supposedly the breadwinner, particularly, I guess, maybe it's changing as society's perception of what is masculine is changing, but also how families are changing as well. But that when a man, as the typical breadwinner of the family, felt emasculated and couldn't provide for that through unemployment or whatever, like, we've been through huge recessions in this country. The 1980s was a huge one. My own parents moved to London because they couldn't get work here, and resulted in my parents are since divorced, you know. Like, it can be a very difficult
thing.
When, as you say, when love goes out the window,
in the door, love runs out
the window.
And it is true, because it has a huge effect on people, because relationships are vulnerable to all the other politics of society, and people forget the children. You don't have time for your children. You snap at them. You're angry with them. You're not angry really with your children, but you're angry with the fact that you can't change your life.
Stress can cause so much.
So what I'm saying, economic inequality produces that, and that feeds into our care relationships.
And I don't know who coined the term, but all politics is personal.
Yeah.
You know, I think sometimes even the word politics can be an intimidating word for a lot of people, because we kind of feel like maybe it's removed from me. It's about people who are in these institutions of power, and I don't really know how to access that or grasp it. It's not tangible for me. But actually, if we think about it the completely opposite way around, if politics is the personal, if I don't feel that I can walk across the green into my estate at night because it's too scary at 11 o'clock at night, that's politics of the personal. That's personal for me. I should feel as a woman that I'm safe to walk through my neighbourhood at a certain hour of the night.
Gender politics is, care politics was gender politics, and it was trivialised like a lot of feminine issues. And we've seen how the feminine has been trivialised in many areas of Irish life, and one way which it's most visible, like the lack of respect for people, for example, who are caring at home full time for people who are sick and elderly, or which adult children with intellectual disabilities who need care. And of course, children also care for their parents and other siblings. So it's, but all I'm saying, there's no real understanding of the importance of friendship and good relationships, because our mental health and our emotional health are as important to the economy as are our economic relationships. Because if people are not, you know, there's a study done that cited there by Wilkinson and Pickett that, I don't know if you know the work of Layard, the economist on happiness, that to make people happy, like the cost of it would be actually enormous if you were to put it down in monetary terms, to try and create friendships and relationships. And what I'm saying is we need time to create those. You know,
and do you feel that this is something that's deteriorating?
Oh, I absolutely am sure. People at work don't have time for coffee. People are too busy working from through their lunch breaks.
You know, somebody pointed out something very interesting to me. Actually, was talking about politics and who is involved in who are politicians in Ireland, and somebody pointed out there's so many people who are former teachers who are in the Dáil, and the reason being, I suppose, because these are people who are already based usually within their own communities or relatively local to their own community. They might live in the community next. Store or whatever.
Teachers, yeah.
But they have got so much free time, I guess. No, that's not fair. I've been a teacher myself, so I work hard. You know, you have plenty of, you know, but you have that nice bit of time in the summer where you are able to engage with your community.
That's
you
right.
are able to keep your finger on the pulse of what is happening. You know, you're engaged with young people, well, you're
I always
engaged
say,
with
like,
parents.
You don't have people who are in a position to engage. And that's the whole dilemma of care politics. The very people who do the work, the imminence, the urgency, the non-transferability of it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't transfer and leave your little baby for the day and go out on a protest.
Yes.
So that's the reality. You can't need somebody who has to have be turned in their bed at night two or three times in case they get bed sores and leave them for the day.
Yes,
that's
yes,
not
yes.
realistic.
And maybe you don't have the time or the energy or the interest by 11 o'clock at night to watch prime time and find out what is going on.
And what I'm saying is because we haven't made politics of care into national politics, the effective injustices are enormous and they are highly gendered, and of course they are increasingly racialized because now we hire often on not very good wages increasingly migrant workers to do the low wage care work that we don't want to do ourselves.
Yes. Well, listen, I am very conscious of your time, Professor Lynch, and I just want to say thank you so much for taking part in the podcast today. It has been absolutely fantastic and once again just shows, you know, why you are on this list as one of the key thinkers in the course. You know, but I just want to finish up by saying, you know, like, you are an absolute whirlwind of a woman. You're certainly, I hugely admire you, you know, as somebody who's coming in doing my PhD here at UCD. You established, together with some of your colleagues, the UCD Equality Studies Centre in 1990. You then went on to establish the UCD School of Social Justice in 2005. You know, it's all ahead of a lot of young people who are probably listening to this. You know, what's your advice to any budding sociologists or young people who are interested in social policy and social justice? What would be your bit of advice to them?
I'd say follow your beliefs and believe in yourself. I think in Ireland, young people in the arts, in particular in humanities, are encouraged to be innovative and to have new ideas. And I remember when we started Equality Studies here, I had this idea and I wrote it, and then I met other colleagues here and we brought it together. And people said to me, well, you can't have it in UCD because it doesn't exist anywhere else. And I said, that's precisely the reason we should have it in UCD.
That's we'll be the first. Yeah.
We will, but it is a good idea. Forget that other people don't want it. You must be inventive. You must not be afraid. And even if you will have many setbacks, you know, as we had establishing all these things, and I didn't do this on my own, let me be clear about that, and lots of other people with me. But I'm just saying, only you believe in it, but follow your heart and your dreams. Don't just go into a job for the sake of it, because it'll destroy you. And I think that's, to me, what kills a lot of young professionals nowadays is they pursue a career rather than their ideals. Yes, there is a price for being idealistic, but the wonderful thing about it is you will follow your dream and you would be amazed at what you can achieve when you have other people with you and when it is a good idea. So that's what I would say. Keep going. Do believe, and you can bring about change. People, I'm always, when people remind people in the 1970s, when I was in my early days of in the university, people are, UK economic inequality here was worse in many ways, and you know, all the indicators, we were far worse than the UK. That is not true anymore. I'm not saying we achieved a miracle, we have a long way to go, but we have brought about certain changes.
Do you mean free education to
Everything.
A certain degree?
Yeah,
healthcare.
We have brought about, we have, you know, we have maintained some respect for the elderly. We've quite good old age pensions, good security, not perfect by any means, but we have held the line. if yes, I want yes. to put that.
And we need to keep doing that.
Yeah,
suppose.
We do.
And it's
then
up
we
to this
need
generation
to create
to
new
enjoy.
Lines. Yeah. Hold the line and don't give in. Don't give up. No pass around.
Professor Lynch, as always, it has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for taking part in the UCD Sociology podcast. I absolutely greatly appreciate it. Thank you.